and now they were supposed to just smile and walk away when they got screwed under the new system? Still, Jennifer Gratz has said that she supports the concept of affirmative action, that she's all in favor of creating greater opportunities for minorities, but that it should be based on income and not on race. Why should a better qualified blue-collar white kid have to step aside for a less qualified upper-middle-class black kid? Oh yeah, one more thing. Did I mention that Bollinger's own son attended the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor? I wonder how much chance there ever was that he'd get turned down because the color of his skin. 23. The Unknown American Terrorist. In the middle of the night on August 1, 2003, a big luxury condominium complex under construction in a picturesque canyon in San Diego went up in flames, sending fire 200 feet into the sky. You could see the glow from miles away. It was such an inferno, firefighters couldn't get anywhere near it. When the sun came up and they surveyed the damage, nothing was left. Every one of the 206 units had been reduced to smoldering rubble. And then nearby, the firefighters saw something else, a banner 12 feet long with a message. "If you build it," it read, "we will burn it," and a taunting postscript, "The Elves are mad." The Elves are members of an underground band of radical environmentalists. ELF is short for Earth Liberation Front, which first surfaced in the mid-90s and whose stated mission is to inflict economic damage on those profiting from the destruction and exploitation of the environment. ELF members in one cell may not even know their fellow green anarchist in another. They're unknown ecological terrorists, and the FBI hasn't been able to stop them. Damage in the San Diego fire was put at $50 million, far and away the most destructive act of eco-terrorism in U.S. history, according to Brian Denson, a reporter for The Oregonian in Portland, one of the most knowledgeable journalists in the country on the subject of the Earth Liberation Front and other domestic terrorist organizations. ELF is the same group that first made headlines back in 1998 when it set fire to a ski resort that was under construction in Vail, Colorado, causing $12 million in damages. They did it, the ELF said, to save the Canada lynx, which roamed the area. But it was during the summer of 2003, the summer of fire, as it's been called, that the Earth Liberation Front earned its reputation as the most destructive and most elusive band of homegrown terrorists in the entire United States. Just 3 weeks after the San Diego fire, the ELF struck again. This time, they hit one of the largest SUV dealerships in the country, in West Covina, a suburb of Los Angeles. This time, Denson reports, firefighters arrived to a scene that looked more like a war zone in Iraq than a place that sells cars. Hummers were burning all over the lot like an ambushed convoy, he wrote, when the firefighters hit a cluster of brand-new $50,000 Hummer H2s with high-pressure water, the exotic metals in the steering column exploded. Flaming plastic dripped from bumpers and splashed to the ground like lava. Tires blew apart yards from their feet. And once again, when the smoke cleared, there was another message for everyone to see. This time, it was spray-painted in red, white, and blue onto the surviving vehicles. SUV suck. Fat, lazy Americans. Earth raper. And again, it was signed, ELF. It had been a busy night for the ELFs. They hit three other car dealerships in the area within hours of each other, spray-painting and setting on fire about 125 SUVs. Damage was put at nearly $5 million. But now, something else was becoming clear to the authorities, beyond the actual damage. It wasn't just what was going up in flames, it was where it was going up in flames. Now they weren't just hitting remote targets in the isolated great outdoors. Now they were hitting major population centers in the suburbs. ELF was taking their war to where Americans lived, and no end was in sight. Almost before the charred ruins from the August fires had cooled down, the Earth Liberation Front struck again in September and October, More luxury homes were set on fire in San Diego. A Walmart was vandalized in Indiana. There was an attempt to burn down a factory that pumps bottled water in Michigan. But in 2004, federal agents made a tiny dent in their war against eco-terrorism. They arrested William Cottrell, a 23-year-old graduate student who was enrolled at the California Institute of Technology, on charges that he helped firebomb and vandalize those 125 SUVs in Southern California 1 year earlier during the summer of fire. At his trial, Cottrell testified that SUV dealers were evil. That little observation, along with his own testimony that he took part in the vandalism, though he insisted he had nothing to do with the firebombing, was enough to convict him. And on April 18, 2005, Cottrell was sentenced to just over 8 years in prison. But the authorities say several accomplices got away and are in hiding, maybe overseas. And because the eco-terrorists operate without a structure, without a president or a recording secretary, authorities have been fighting a losing battle, the Cottrell conviction notwithstanding. Trying to catch these guys, the former FBI chief of domestic terrorism has said, is sort of like grasping at smoke. 22. Michael Newdow. Back in 2002, after a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, by far the nation's most liberal, declared the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance unconstitutional, we were all forced to make the acquaintance of one Michael Newdow, the California atheist who brought the case. Over the time since, as the case made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court and Newdow made his way through countless TV studios, we have learned a fair amount about him. We've learned that Newdow, who is both a doctor and a lawyer, is a well-spoken and passionate advocate for his cause, a true anti-religion zealot. We learn that he is doing this because, I don't believe in God, and every school morning my child is asked to stand up, face that flag, put her hand over her heart, and say her father is wrong. And oh yeah, we've also learned that, in fact, neither the 9-year-old daughter in question nor the child's mother, who has actual custody, has any problem at all with reciting the pledge. I'm not a lawyer or a constitutional scholar, so I'm not about to argue the fine legal points of whether those two words, under God, amount to an unconstitutional establishment of religion, although I don't see how they do. Unfortunately, we got no help from the Supreme Court, which never decided the fundamental issue, ruling instead that Newdow had no legal grounds to challenge the Pledge of Allegiance in the first place, since he's not the girl's custodial parent, thus tossing out the Ninth Circuit's decision. But after the Supreme Court dismissed his case, Newdow promised he'd be back. And, God bless him, on January 4, 2005, he was. This time, he didn't go to court alone. This time, he rounded up 8 atheist co-plaintiffs, all of them custodial parents or the children themselves, and went to federal court in Sacramento, California, where he filed another suit challenging the Pledge of Allegiance. Heaven knows where it all will lead, but if Newdow gets another crack at the highest court in the land, anything is possible. But you know what? People like Newdow have it exactly backward. As members of proudly aggrieved minorities, they regard themselves as brave and noble, true defenders of freedom for pushing an agenda that runs roughshod over the values and beliefs of their fellow citizens. Because Newdow was offended by "under God," he'd see to it that no one got to recite the words. Yet, genuine tolerance is grounded in respect for the opinions and beliefs of others, even when, gasp, call the ACLU, the others in question happen to be the majority. Look, I understand the obvious, that atheists don't want some invisible man who lives in the sky, as they put it, so much as mentioned in public schools or in any other public arena for that matter. But are these two little words really such a big deal? Is this a battle that has to be fought? Is it worth the friction that it has caused? Like the insistence by the intolerantly tolerant that we say Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas, something even non-Christians have happily repeated for generations, it needlessly sets us at one another's throats. As Judge Ferdinand Fernandez warned in his dissent to the Ninth Circuit's original ruling on the Newdow case, such a decision would have far-reaching consequences, starting with the banning of patriotic songs in public places. God Bless America and America the Beautiful would be gone for sure, he observed. Can anyone really make the case that we would be better for that? Is that anyone's idea of freedom? 21. Judge Roy Moore. Let's say a liberal judge went way beyond the usual activist stuff. Let's say he not only interpreted the law to fit his own politics, which happens all the time, but went a giant step further. Let's say he flat out disregarded the law by refusing to obey a ruling handed down by a higher court. And let's say he did it simply because he was convinced that he knew what was right and what was wrong, and that's all that mattered. If that happened, conservatives would be up in arms, and they'd be right. They'd say, this is a huge part of what's wrong with America today. Activist judges taking the law into their own hands and thumbing their smug noses at anyone who disagrees with them. And they'd be right about that, too. So what should we make of Judge Roy Moore, the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, until he was removed from office for defying a federal judge's order to remove a Ten Commandments monument from the rotunda of the state Supreme Court building? Let me be absolutely clear. This is not about whether the federal judge made the right decision in ordering the 2.6-ton monument removed, nor is it about whether there's a place in general for symbols like the Ten Commandments inside our courtrooms. On that, reasonable people may disagree. No, this is about something much simpler. It's about respecting the law. Disagree or not with the order that the monument had to go, it was a higher court's ruling, and Judge Moore refused to obey it, period. On November 14, 2003, Alabama's 9-member Court of the Judiciary listened to arguments from both sides on whether or not he had the right to disobey a higher court's ruling. Then, in a unanimous decision, decided he didn't and removed Roy Moore from office. Afterwards, Moore was defiant, claiming, it's about whether or not we can acknowledge God as the source of our law and our liberty. That's all I've done, and I've been found guilty. No, Judge, that's not all you've done. If it were, you'd still be on the bench. What you did was break the law by disobeying a federal judge's ruling. Ordinary citizens may practice civil disobedience and risk punishment for what they see as a greater good, but judges cannot. Imagine if not just one, but hundreds of judges all over the country did what Judge Moore did, and not just in matters involving religion, but in a whole variety of cases. We would have anarchy. As John Gibbs, the Assistant Attorney General of Alabama, eloquently summed up the case against Judge Moore before the panel that would determine his fate. What message does that send to the public, he said, to other litigants? The message is this. If you don't like a court order, you don't have to follow it. What Judge Moore did, he added, undercuts the entire workings of the judicial system. Amen. 20. Howard Dean. While he was campaigning for president and still the Democratic frontrunner, Howard Dean was riding high and could afford to be generous, but that wasn't in his nature. After he finished a speech at the community center in the little town of Old Wine, Iowa, he asked the crowd, which was overwhelmingly in his corner, if there were any questions, comments, or rude remarks anyone had in response to what they had just heard. With that, Dale Ungerer, a 66-year-old retiree and a Bush supporter from Hawkeye, Iowa, got up and said what a lot of Americans had been thinking. Please tone down the garbage, the mean-mouthing, the tearing down of your neighbor and being so pompous, Mr. Ungerer said. You should help your neighbor and not tear him down. To which Howard Dean bluntly replied, George Bush is not my neighbor. Yes, he is, Unger went on, prompting Howard Dean to angrily tell him, You sit down, you've had your say, and now I'm going to have my say. The Dean crowd loved it. They cheered, none of them, I suspect, realizing that what had just occurred was very revealing about their guy, and very bad for the candidate who was supposed to be unbeatable. Forget the fact that he had just told a senior citizen to sit down and put a sock in it, already not the smartest thing to do in the world of politics. Maybe even worse, he had brashly and without the slightest hint of embarrassment rejected the idea that the President of the United States was his neighbor with shared values and shared concerns for the well-being of the country. Why? Because they simply disagreed about things. It would have been one thing if, say, George Bush believed in slavery, or if he thought Gay should be taken out and shot, then I wouldn't want to call him my neighbor either. But this was something else entirely. This was the language of anger and arrogance, a language in which Dr. Dean was fluent. A week later, Iowans went to their caucuses, and frontrunner Howard Dean was history. This time, it was the voters who told him to sit down and be quiet. But here's the depressing part. Millions of liberals loved his angry man persona. Hey, he was angry with George W. Bush and conservatives, and that was A-okay with them. All that anger was fine, right up until it became painfully obvious that in the real world of politics, too much anger is a big fat liability. In the end, the problem for them wasn't that Howard Dean was smug and mean without even the pretense of respect for anyone who disagreed with him. It was only that he was unelectable. Of course, Howard Dean didn't invent anger in politics, but more than anyone else in recent years, he aggressively tapped into it, and in his own dark way, legitimized it, at least for his rabid supporters. Like their leader, they didn't see their political opponents as neighbors either, but as the enemy. The very term Dr. Dean used to describe George Bush, not opponent, but enemy. Even Nixon would have been stunned. He only talked that way in private. And while Dean may never have personally called George Bush a moron or a Nazi, at least not that we know of, he certainly made it easier for all the haters to say exactly that. And while he may not have come up with the idea for the bumper sticker so popular in certain liberal suburban neighborhoods during the campaign, Friends Don't Let Friends Vote Republican, it perfectly mirrored his smug intolerance. Politics was never a pretty, polite game, but it became a lot uglier and a lot nastier than it had to be, thanks in large part to Dean, who might have quietly gone home to Vermont after the election and done everybody a great big favor. But no. In February 2005, Howard Dean was back, emerging from the ashes to announce, I hate Republicans and everything they stand for, and then becoming head of the Democratic National Committee, a grand victory for all the others like him on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, in San Francisco, in Beverly Hills, and one or two other places, if not for the Democratic Party itself. 19. George Soros. In an age of reckless slander, no charge is so vicious as the one that has become so common on the American left, that their political and ideological opponents are Nazis. Then again, there are slanderers and there are slanderers, which brings us to George Soros, who may be the most influential Bush hater of them all. When Soros talks about George Bush and the Nazis in the same sentence as he has, you have to wonder, A, is he losing his marbles? Or B, does he, like a lot of other hardcore lefties, figure that linking Bush and Hitler is just telling it like it is? Unfortunately, Soros is not some glassy-eyed radical spouting off in some dingy corner of the World Wide Web. George Soros is loaded. He's worth about $7 billion, give or take a billion. He is a very big player in the world of finance and democratic politics. He is polished and moves in respectable circles. He sits down with important journalists who hold him in high regard. So when he talks, people listen. And in an interview with the Washington Post during the 2004 presidential campaign, George Soros said, When I hear Bush say, "You're either with us or against us," it reminds me of the Germans. Gee, what Germans could George possibly be talking about? Well, here's a hint. According to the Post, Soros believes that the Bush White House is guided by a supremacist ideology. Germans? Supremacist? Why is the word Nazi popping into my head? Well, because, as the Post Laura Blumenthal writes, Soros hears echoes in the Bush White House's rhetoric of his childhood in occupied Hungary. It conjures up memories, he said, of Nazi slogans on the walls that read, "The enemy is listening." "My experiences under Nazi and Soviet rule have sensitized me," Soros tells the reporter, effortlessly linking Bush to both the commies and the Nazis in just one little sentence. And he said it, the reporter tells us, in a soft Hungarian accent. Boy, am I glad that Soros is sensitive. I'd hate to think of what he might say about George Bush if he were insensitive. Soros spent about $25 million trying to defeat Bush, an effort he called the central focus of my life. And he was the big money behind the relentlessly anti-Bush left-wing political outfit MoveOn.org. Not only has he helped make Bush equal Nazi talk commonplace and mainstream, he has helped make it respectably mainstream. For the record, Soros insists that he never compared George Bush to the Nazis, only that Bush reminded him of the Germans. Really? Which ones? Heidi Klum and Steffi Graf? A piece of advice, Mr. Soros, knock it off before somebody calls you a German. 18. Al Gore. Okay, it's not exactly a newsflash that politicians will say and do just about anything to get elected. But there may never have actually been a pal who actually lived that truism more fully than Al Gore. Of course, I'm referring to the old Al Gore, the wooden and ever-calculating Al Gore, the lockbox Al Gore, the Buddhist fundraising, internet-creating, love story poster boy Al Gore, the one we came to know and loathe during the 80s and 90s, that Al Gore. That was the Al Gore who, at the 1996 Democratic National Convention, recounted the story about how his sister started smoking as a teenager and died from lung cancer at the age of 45 in 1984. 3,000 young people in America will start smoking tomorrow, Gore passionately told the delegates in the hall and the millions of Americans watching at home on television. 1,000 of them will die a death not unlike my sister's, and that is why, until I draw my last breath, I will pour my heart and soul into the cause of protecting our children from the dangers of smoking. This was Al Gore, morally outraged and wanting everyone to know it. So how do you figure this? In 1988, when he ran for the Democratic presidential nomination, the same Al Gore boasted to a crowd in North Carolina, right there in the heart of tobacco country, "Throughout most of my life, I raised tobacco. I want you to know that with my own hands, all my life, I sprayed it. I've chopped it. I've shredded it, spiked it, put it in the barn and stripped it and sold it." And this, remember, was 4 years after his sister's death. You don't have to be a cynic to conclude that Al Gore was for tobacco when he thought that would help him get votes, and against it when he thought that would help him get votes. And to hell with principle. In fact, you'd have to be pretty naive to think anything else. But Al Gore had a different explanation, something about how it took a while for the death of his sister to sink in and for him to do the right thing. It was the numbness, he said, after his sister's death that made him slow to get out of the tobacco business and stop taking money from tobacco companies. Sometimes you never fully face up to things that you ought to face up to, he said. Back then I wondered what Al Gore would be like if someone let him out of his cage, if he were unencumbered by personal ambition, if he were unleashed and could say whatever he felt like saying. What would the real Al Gore sound like? Well, after he lost by a whisker in 2000, we all found out. He came out of seclusion after the Florida recount a free man. Out was the wooden man of caution, In was a new man with no controlling legal authority to keep him in check, and no feminist consultant to tell him how to dress. So who was this new Al Gore? Someone who made even most Democrats long for the old one, that's who. The new Al was a fire-breathing dragon that didn't even fake moderation anymore. During the 2004 presidential campaign, the new Al Gore didn't really speak at rallies. He bellowed, like a beast unchained. In Nashville, he ranted at a crowd that President Bush betrayed this country by going to war in Iraq. Iraq might indeed be a big mistake, but betrayed? That would make the president guilty of treason, right? At New York University, reaching decibel levels usually reserved for ball games and boxing matches, as one news item put it, he called for the resignation of top Bush officials, including Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice. "How dare they subject us to such dishonor and disgrace," he shouted. "How dare they drag the good name of the United States of America through the mud of Saddam Hussein's torture prison." In another stemwinder, Gore said that George W. Bush created more anger and righteous indignation against us as Americans than any leader of our country in the 228 years of our existence as a nation because of his attitude of contempt for any person, institution, or nation who disagrees with him. You really have to wonder about a guy who condemns the President of the United States more often and with much more enthusiasm than he condemns, oh, let's just pick a name, Osama bin Laden. It's enough to make you miss the old Al Gore, the one always ready to pander to any group at any time for a few votes, the one who would exploit his dead sister to win an election. I don't know about you, but I like that Al Gore, the toady par excellence, a lot better than the one we've got today. 17. Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton could have been somebody, not just a contender for the presidency, a run nobody in his right mind ever took seriously, or the host of a cable TV reality show, but somebody who made a real lasting difference in this country. He's got charisma, a way with words, and he can belt out a message. Americans might have listened to him and might have taken him seriously. But mainly over the years, what we've gotten from Al Sharpton is the tiresome blame game, the same old song and dance about white racism and indifference to people of color. Who, besides Al Sharpton, cares how many black or brown people were in Howard Dean's cabinet when he was governor of Vermont? I don't think even black or brown people give a damn. What a waste. And Sharpton doesn't even pretend to be consistent. Even though he has become America's most visible gladiator against bigotry, real or imagined, somehow he manages to make accommodations for certain major league bigots, the kind he surely would publicly condemn in front of TV cameras, of course, if only they were white. Take the late and not-so-great Khalid Mohammed, best known for his gay-bashing, Jew-hating, anti-Catholic tirades. Not only did the Reverend Sharpton share a stage with this vicious screwball, he actually praised Mohammed as an articulate and courageous brother. Then there's that other tower of virtue, Tawana Brawley, the black girl who famously claimed that a gang of white men raped her. Al Sharpton, the gladiator, went running to her defense, and even as it became increasingly clear that, in fact, Tawana Brawley had not been raped by white guys or by anyone else, Sharpton, as a court subsequently ruled, went ahead and slandered and defamed one of the innocent men supposedly involved. On January 12, 2003, 16 long years after she perpetrated the hoax, Tim Russert on Meet the Press gave Sharpton an opportunity to do the right thing and apologize for his role in fanning the racial flames, something that for years he had steadfastly refused to do. Dream on, Tim. To apologize for believing and standing with a woman, I think all of us need to take women's claims more seriously, he told Russert without so much as a wink. And when Russert pressed Sharpton a few more times, finally asking, "No apology for Tawana Brawley?" Sharpton replied, No apology for standing up for civil rights. Then there were Sharpton's role in the Freddy's episode, and the 8 dead people in its wake. In 1995, Freddy's Fashion Mart, a Jewish-owned discount clothing store in Harlem, reportedly gave its subtenant, a popular black-owned record store, an ultimatum: pay more rent or move out. When the owner of the record store refused to pay, Freddy's, or others say the landlord of both properties, a black Pentecostal church, planned to evict him. Presto, a picket line appeared outside the store set up by an organization run by Al Sharpton. Soon after that, rallying his forces outside the store, the Reverend declared, "We will not stand by and allow them to move this brother so that some white interloper can expand his business." The pickets marched outside Freddy's for months. Customers going into the store were spat upon and called names like Traitor and Uncle Tom. One man reportedly shouted, "Burn down the Jew store." On December 8, 1995, at 10:12 in the morning, one of the protesters did just that. He burst into Freddy's and announced, "It's on now, all blacks out." He then shot 4 employees, poured paint thinner on several bins of clothing, and set the store on fire. 7 innocent people and the gunman died in the blaze. Despite his white interloper remark, Al Sharpton denied he egged anybody on, telling reporters, "I am a preacher, not a prophet. I could not know in advance what this was going to come to." Being Al Sharpton means never having to say you're sorry. Indeed, as Al Sharpton's most fawning apologists, the elites routinely make the case that he's the voice for the voiceless and all that, and that all that other stuff is ancient history. They talk rhapsodically about the new Al Sharpton. But can there really be a new Al Sharpton as long as the old one is so blissfully unrepentant, so adamantly unwilling to take any responsibility for the Tawana Brawley mess, for the escalation of racial tensions that led to the deaths at Freddy's, and for, as Peter Bonnert put it in the New Republic, all the other moral train wrecks that dot his career? It calls to mind a line that Christopher Hitchens, the journalist and author, came up with for the Wall Street Journal. "It's always interesting when people don't seem to feel shame or embarrassment," he wrote. "And it's often not a very good sign." 16. John Edwards. I guess you could say we owe John Edwards some thanks, though it's an open question whether he's the most shameless millionaire trial lawyer in America over the last couple of decades. There's a lot of competition, after all. He's definitely the one who's brought some long overdue attention to the way people like him do what they do, which is win enormous financial rewards by ignoring the facts to play on juries' emotions, and in the process, do great damage to countless blameless medical practitioners and the patients they serve. Don't get me wrong, there are many legitimate, often heartbreaking cases of medical malpractice, and those who are victimized by it deserve fair compensation. But thanks to people like Edwards, for years the top personal injury lawyer in North Carolina, malpractice law has moved far beyond a search for justice into something more like a treasure hunt. And ultimately, all of us pay the price, both literally and in the sense of living in a society where emotion increasingly trumps reason. Take Edwards' very first case, the one that made his reputation. His clients were the parents of a child born with cerebral palsy. Edwards claimed the baby got that way because the doctor waited too long to perform a cesarean. In his closing argument, Edwards told the jury that the child speaks to you through me. "And I have to tell you right now, I didn't plan to talk about it, but right now I feel her. I feel her presence. She's inside me, and she's talking to you." As the lawyer for the other side later said, it was just such a blatant appeal to emotions, like putting up a sign, "I'm appealing to your emotions." But John could get away with it. Or in the words of a former state court judge in North Carolina, "He has an ingratiating way, particularly with jurors, and particularly with women on juries." In fact, He was so ingratiating that the jury came back with a $6.5 million verdict in the case, the first of many huge awards Edwards would go on to win. There's just one problem. According to the overwhelming weight of evidence, the medical care in such cases has nothing to do with the fact that the child is born with cerebral palsy. In fact, studies have found that the vast majority of children born with cerebral palsy suffered fetal brain injury long before labor began. One statistic is especially revealing. In 1970, cesareans accounted for only 4% of deliveries in the United States, while they account for about 25% today. Yet the incidence of cerebral palsy hasn't dropped at all. Let's look at the actual consequences of trial lawyers like John Edwards on the lives of ordinary people, the ones he claims to speak for. For one thing, ordinary women in labor today are far more likely to be subjected to the major surgery of cesareans, not so much for medical as for legal reasons. Doctors call it defensive medicine, decisions made primarily to avoid litigation and not based strictly on medical considerations. Doctors are afraid they'll get sued if they don't do a cesarean. What if something goes wrong during the delivery? What if anything goes wrong? Do a cesarean, and you cut the chances of spending your life in a courtroom. After all, it's a fact that while doctors are often sued for not doing a cesarean, they're almost never sued for doing an unnecessary cesarean. Even worse, with as many as 76% of American obstetricians reporting having been sued, fewer and fewer young doctors are going into this vitally important area, leaving entire regions of the country without adequate obstetric care. But such lawsuits are hurting the nation in another less obvious but no less important way. By reinforcing the false idea that there's always someone to blame when things go wrong. The fact is, sometimes there's not. Strong, resourceful people understand that life can be hard and it's not always fair. And when things go wrong, they don't point fingers. They deal with it. John Edwards, meanwhile, sues the Red Cross for unknowingly transmitting the AIDS virus through tainted blood products. And what have been the consequences of all this on John Edwards personally? The revenue that he was producing was an out-of-body experience, recalls one of his former law partners. John would pick up an $800,000 fee for making a few phone calls. Though Edwards refuses to disclose his net worth, it has been estimated at anywhere from $12 million to $60 million. More important, Edwards' law career, both his reputation as a fighter for the little guy and the fortune and contacts he made during those years, have been the foundation of his political career. His campaigns overwhelmingly have been financed by trial lawyers who, in John Edwards, have a champion in the fight against meaningful reform of the legal system. And lawyers, just for the record, are now the largest contributors to the Democratic Party in general. And just as bad, Edwards hasn't hesitated to introduce his brand of smarmy emotionalism into the national political arena either. Who can forget his reaction to the sad news in the closing weeks of the 2004 presidential campaign that Christopher Reeve had died? "If we do the work that we can do in this country," Edwards told a rally of supporters, "the work that we will do when John Kerry is president, people like Christopher Reeve are going to walk, get up out of that wheelchair, and walk again." This is just the kind of thing John Edwards would say to one of his gullible juries. The man is as cynically unscrupulous as they come, a latter-day two-bit snake oil salesman. And for all his supposed respect for the little guy, John Edwards clearly believes the little guy is an idiot. I'm not surprised by what he did, just that he didn't also promise to cure dandruff and raise the dead if he and Kerry were elected. All in all, it's easy to understand those doctors who, at the American Medical Association's 2004 annual meeting, proposed a resolution saying that, except in emergencies, it should be okay to refuse to treat certain trial lawyers and their families. But no, after heated debate, the proposal failed. The doctors were too ethical. At least someone is. 15. Ted Rall. Even on the furthest fringes of the American bashing left, distinctions have to be made. There is loathsome, and there is beneath loathsome. And then, there's Ted Rall. Rall is the editorial cartoonist, columnist, radio commentator, and all-around creep whose work often borders on the psychopathic. He is to reasonable debate what hyenas are to opera. On May 3, 2004, while the nation was mourning the death in Afghanistan of Pat Tillman, who gave up a big salary pro football career to fight for his country, Ted Rall produced a cartoon that summed up his special brand of social commentary. You may remember Pat Tillman, the NFL pro who enlisted in the Army rather than accept a $3.6 million football contract, read the words above the first crudely drawn panel, which showed Tillman at the Army recruiting station. Never mind the fine print, Rall has him telling the recruiting officer. Will I get to kill Arabs? Over the next three panels, Tillman is depicted as a dupe, a cog in a low-rent occupation army that shot more innocent civilians than terrorists to prop up puppet rulers and exploit gas and oil resources. And as an idiot who got killed by the Afghan resistance. But the problem with Ted Rall is not simply that he's a vicious, conspiracy-minded, hate-filled jerk. It's also that his commentary is seen in some circles as respectable and legitimate. His stuff, after all, appears not in crank anarchist flyers no one sees, but in 140 newspapers across the country, including the Los Angeles Times, the San Jose Mercury News, and yes, occasionally, even in the Sunday New York Times. He is a two-time winner of the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award and has been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And though his diatribe against Tillman was so offensive that most outlets refused to run it, it was by no means an aberration. Just the next month, in fact, when Ronald Reagan passed away, Ted Rall was at it again, this time in the guise of a columnist. As the rest of the nation, including one-time political opponents, celebrated the life and career of the former president, Rall ranted that Reagan was in hell, turning crispy brown right about now. In response to the outrage that followed, which Rall seemed to enjoy, he kept piling it on. Reagan was a public figure, and he was an idiot. We hated him during the dark days he made so hideous, and with all due respect, we hate him still. The man was the scum of the earth. And when George W. Bush won re-election, Ted Rall was right there with another piece of brilliant analysis. So our guy lost the election, he wrote. Why shouldn't those of us on the coast feel superior? We eat better, travel more, dress better, watch cooler movies, earn better salaries, meet more interesting people, listen to better music, and know more about what's going on in the world. If you voted for Bush, we accept that we have to share the country with you. We're adjusting to the possibility that there may be more of you than there are of us. But don't demand our respect. You lost it on November 2nd. When Rall produced his sickening cartoon about Pat Tillman, many hopelessly ordinary Americans did indeed decide they weren't going to take it and bombarded Rall's syndicate with angry messages of protest. And on the internet, someone posted a parody of the offensive cartoon that was smarter by far than anything Ted Rall has ever done. You may remember Ted Rall, it says, over Rall's original drawing, very slightly altered, so it now depicts Rall in his editor's office, the no-talent cartoonist who makes his living mocking the sacrifices of the dead. Actually, it goes on, he's a cog in a low-rent anti-American movement that practices moral equivalency and emboldens those who would terrorize America. 14. Mary Mapes. Mary Mapes, Dan Rather's producer at CBS News, is mainstream journalism's worst nightmare. Someone so zealous that her actions lend way to every question about fairness that has been raised about the entire news industry. Give Mapes credit. She set her sights high. She was out to bag the President of the United States of America. Do not underestimate how much I want this story, she wrote to a colleague. And if she had to use dubious documents to do it, well, so be it. Her story, which aired on 60 Minutes Wednesday, just 55 days before the 2004 presidential election, and claimed George W. Bush dodged his National Guard service in the early 70s, set off a firestorm. Unfortunately for Mary Mapes and CBS News, the documents that were supposed to back up those allegations were apparently as phony as a six-legged hound dog in a rented tuxedo at a 4th of July picnic in Amarillo, as Mary Mapes' correspondent on the story, Dan Rather, might put it. Except he not only didn't put it that way, what he did, along with Mapes, was stubbornly stick by his guns that the documents were genuine, even though everybody and his dumb cousin had serious suspicions right after the piece aired that they weren't. Mapes and Rather said they had complete confidence in the story because they had complete confidence in their unimpeachable source, who turned out to be about as reliable as a cheap watch at the bottom of a swimming pool. Oh yeah, he also had a long history of detesting George Bush, which was no secret either, and he actually asked Mapes to put him in touch with a top operative in the Kerry campaign, which incredibly she did. Now, of course, Mary Mapes is Dan Rather's former producer, fired outright for her leading role in the most public, humiliating, reputation-trashing screw-up in CBS News history. So how could something this bad happen? Turns out there's something about Mary that helps answer that question. She went into journalism with an axe to grind, that is, to promote feminism, and radical feminism, I might say, and liberalism, is how someone who knew her quite well put it. That the someone is her own father, Don Mapes, is sad. It seems that they had a falling out years ago. But whatever his reason for speaking up, apparently he knew what he was talking about. According to CBS News, Mapes had been working on the story on and off for more than 5 years. A lot of marriages don't last that long. More than 5 years is not journalism. It's an obsession. Captain Ahab wasn't as fixated on Moby Dick as Mary Mapes was on George Bush. The independent panel CBS brought in to investigate the mess concluded that it was myopic zeal to be first with the story that led CBS News down the perilous road that has done so much damage to its credibility, and that it could not say that political bias played a role in the debacle. Really? It's true that there was no smoking gun, no memo from Mapes to Rather saying, "Hey, Dan, let's screw Bush." But that's not how bias works at places like CBS News. There are no conspiracies, no secret meetings in dark offices where collaborators give secret handshakes and map out plans to bring down their enemies. Instead, it's groupthink. It's the mindset of the elite newsroom, the bubble in which Mary Mapes had been operating at CBS News since they hired her from KIRO in Seattle in 1989. CBS News, after all, was a place where no one saw her obsession as an obsession, because like Mapes, many of them also wanted the anti-Bush story to be true. Most of the time, the bias is not so obvious as it was this time. Most of the time, it doesn't blow up in everybody's face. That's the good news. The bad news is, it's always there. Always. Which is why the question that lingers after the scandal is only indirectly about Mary Mapes. The question that is still with us today is how many other Mary Mapeses are still out there in the news business, passing off ideologically driven stuff as honest news. 13. Andrew Hayward. 50 years ago, Harry Truman memorably described leadership with character with just four simple words, "The buck stops here," and he meant it. As I am recording this in May 2005, Andrew Hayward is still the president of CBS News, a job you would think that also requires a certain amount of leadership with character. Hayward is a smart man, Harvard Phi Beta Kappa, but he must have been absent from school the day they taught about Truman and leadership and the kind of dignity that comes with having the moral courage to do the right thing. Of all the entries in this recording, this is by far the hardest for me to talk about. Not only did I work closely with Andrew for 20 of my 28 years at CBS, but I also considered him one of my closest friends. And I think I know him better than anyone at CBS News. I know beyond question that he knows right from wrong in the world of news. But I also know that, like so many other businessmen, when his own personal interests are involved, he'll do what he has to do, and leadership with character be damned. I guess this is not an uncommon trait in human beings. To some extent, we all look out for number one. That's how we survive in this world. But it seems to me that more and more in our culture, especially in our corporate culture, looking out for number one has become an art form at which way too many executives have become way too adept, which is why we have fewer and fewer leaders with character today, the kind who are willing to say, the buck stops here, and mean it. This is a large part of the reason why so many of us think back so fondly on characters of days gone by, men like Will Kane, the marshal in High Noon, who at great danger to himself stood up for what he knew was right, or Atticus Finch, who took on an ugly culture in To Kill a Mockingbird because it was the right thing to do. Men like that were never abundant, but they are in desperately short supply these days. My old friend Andrew Hayward is not a bad person. Actually, he's a nice guy, capable of great kindness. But in his professional role, I'm sorry to say, he is a fitting representative for all those cover-your-ass-me-first corporate types. According to none other than Dan Rather, Andrew Hayward, who fired CBS News producer Mary Mapes and demanded the resignations of three other friends and colleagues involved in the Memogate scandal, was himself neck-deep in the mess from the start. Rather told the New York Times about a conversation he had with Hayward before the phony story ever got on the air. "I said, Andrew, if it's true, it's breakthrough stuff, but I need to do something unusual. It may even be unique. I have to ask you to oversee in a hands-on way the handling of this story, because this is potentially the kind of thing that will cause great controversy." He got it. He immediately agreed, Rather said. And let's be clear about another thing. In the world of television news, stories don't get on the air by magic. Someone has to give the final okay. In the case of the 60 Minutes story that might have brought down the President of the United States, Andrew Hayward, as president of CBS News, was that someone. So, if four of Hayward's friends and colleagues had to go, why didn't Andrew Hayward have to go too? Because his boss, Leslie Moonves, said Andrew's failures were trusting lieutenants with orders that were not being carried out. The same could be said of everyone who trusted Mary Mapes, the discredited producer of the piece, but that wasn't enough to save any of them. As a leader, Andrew Hayward could have said, "The buck stops here," but there would have been a price to pay for that. 12. Dan Rather. In August 2004, when the Swift Boat Vets for Truth were taking aim at John Kerry and causing a lot of damage, a prominent journalist told a national magazine,